Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to episode 134 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode, I am joined by a huge fan of The Jam and Paul Weller, singer, songwriter, Nick Haywood. Now, Nick burst onto the scene in the early 80s with his band Haircut 100 and the debut album Pelican West, which has just been re-released to celebrate the 40th anniversary. In this episode of the podcast, Nick talks about his love of The Jam, connections with Paul Weller from the man who signed them, Chris Parry, to legendary publisher, the late Brian Morrison, photographers Gerard Mankiewicz and Lawrence Watson, to sleeve designer Simon Halfen, and so much more. And we kick off chatting about the band's recent performance on BBC Radio 2's The Piano Room. Let's get into it. Nick Haywood, thanks for joining me.
Lovely to be here, Dan. Lovely to be here.
I'm so glad that you found the time in what is a really chaotic time period for you right now. I mean, before we just start recording, we were talking about this week, and it's been a mad week, hasn't it?
It has. It's just been one. It's typical Haircut 100 week. It's got a Haircut 100 is like a rush of adrenaline. You know, like Maximum 100%, you know, all those early Who posters and things. That's what this band has. It's just a kind of like an energy of itself. It's like, sometimes I feel like it's a magic door, like a portal to some kind of like other adrenaline filled, cortisol filled world. And something happened yesterday which got me ready for it. I got attacked by a dog on my, just taking a calm country walk. And as a dog lover, 61 years so far, I've never had that. And it was just like typical Haircut stuff. You know, I didn't sleep at all. You know, my wife and I just were like wide awake the whole night. You know, on the night where you just want to be, this was us kind of like out of nowhere land, suddenly onto the biggest gig in town on Radio 2. And we're like, and we're playing with an orchestra. We haven't played for 10 years. Hold on a minute. So I went on there with no sleep at all. And kind of just like, right, kind of got through it somehow. Yeah, it was crazy. It was emotional, really emotional as well. I mean, Les, our bass player, was in tears. Graham lost it. I lost it this morning after, like, because I didn't sleep the whole day. Les was in tears just hearing the strings. Because it's a bit of a story for us of the kind of whole 40 years of not being able to make it together. And suddenly, it's just all fallen into place, like naturally, kind of organically. We just are together, never got on as well as this. It's just like we're all the you know, Les Graham and I are just back almost in a feeling like we were when we lived together above a flower shop in Gloucester Road. It's just we're mates again. It's like all through the last 40 years didn't exist, and suddenly the stars are aligned, and it's like we're all just kind of, wow, this feels so good. Naturally.
It's time that you needed, right? So you needed 40 years to get to be the band that you needed to be and you can be and all that, yeah.
Yeah, it's really weird. We don't understand it, but we're not questioning it because we go like, is this weird or what? You know, is this feel right? I've never felt this way. So right. I think we just needed to grow up or something, obviously, and mature and have loads of crap stuff happen and then kind of grow and then be able to appreciate everything, be humble. Be thankful, be grateful. I don't know what it is, and really not back and surprised by all the love for the band. I mean, it was, you know, there was people in yesterday there, the head of BBC came down because he's a fan. And it's just like people who were fans then and couldn't admit to it. I'm not going to get beaten up now. You know, I can say I was a 100 fan, you know, great name that. Yeah. Really good name. Cool. Yeah. But at the time, it was a bit like, you know, we launched off a cool launch pad through the NME and things and London. And then quite quickly, it just went girl screaming, which was a blessing in disguise of it. Most bands do have it at the beginning of their careers, kind of thing, if they're young. But we did have it. And, you know, I mean, in hindsight, we look back and kind of go, oh, God, you know, when I look at the camera and think, look at stuff and go, God, that kind of like cute look. Oh my God, that's so embarrassing, you know.
we all do that with old photos, but some of us don't have the thing of where they were covered all over the front of magazines and newspapers and all that, you know.
Yeah, but the seduction stuff, that's just embarrassing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, they're trying to look like James Dean, and that's okay. Like, we're cool, you know, like in pictures, you know, going like this, like we were doing, but. You know, all that kind of like stuff, and all that, you know, you just kind of go
the longing look. Yeah.
But you can't be too hard on yourself because you just think that's what young guys do. You know, they'll do anything to be attractive. You know, it's like I think it's just a natural thing. It's like, what can I do to meet ladies? You know, what is it that we have to do? And but you know, now it's all about the music. We did get to rehearse. For a day, so we did get to play. Not after 40 years, that wasn't thrown in with an orchestra that much in the deep end. But you know, it was still just an afternoon in a rehearsal, brilliant rehearsal studio, actually Hive, fantastic rehearsal studio. But it was just kind of like we started playing, and it was lovely. It was so lovely.
I love this. I love the passion for this. You're talking about the band like it's a new band and this is a new project. And I get why. Like, you're so excited about it. It's brilliant. And here we are, like, you know, performing at the legendary Maid of Vale, for goodness sake, on the BBC. Like you say, the biggest radio show in Europe, Ken Bruce on Radio 2.
Yeah. And that didn't happen with any kind of company. There's no company behind us. This is all organic. This is just some guy at the BBC thought, I'd like to get them. They seem to be back together. Okay, yeah. Nobody arranged it, kind of thing.
People have to dig this out on BBC Sounds. You can watch it as well. That's the thing. So, and we get Love Plus One, we get Fantastic Day, and these songs that we say 40 years old still sound as fresh as anything, still sound great. But also a lovely Harry Styles cover as well.
It goes like the clappers, that song. What a brilliant song. We started doing it immediately. We did it about five different ways. In fact, a kind of roots dub version we really liked, but... By then, all the strings had set in place. It's, you know, you've got to stick to the template. But actually, we chewed it around for a bit. The Bossa Nova one really worked as well, the kind of Style Council one.
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah. But in the end, it was just like, well, let's just kind of like do it in its spirit. Because that's why I sung the lyric Harry, because it's, you know, it's not my song, but I'm giving respect to the artist and I'm giving respect to the people that wrote the song. And also, I felt like I was more like Harry's dad, you know, Harry's father, or even grandfather now, sort of like, well, you know, what are you doing alone on the floor? What are you doing at home? You know, what kind of pills you're on? Come on, get up, you know. So I had to kind of build a story around it, the kind of imagination of what it is. How could I own this song a bit? And so we all did that, you know. Blair just went like the clappers, as he does. It's like, okay, Blair, you know, and he was off. And Les grooved, as he does. He grooves with him. And Graham was just suddenly, because he's like more rock. He was really into the Clash. Graham was, when I first met him, he was full Clash regalia, everything, the hat, the chains everywhere and everything. Yeah, I met him outside the Wimpy Bar in Beckenham. You know, he was actually going out with my ex-girlfriend. But such is life then, you know, ex-girlfriend didn't mean you don't don't talk to each other. It's just like, oh, you know, respect.
No, I want to take you right back to the very beginning. Okay, let's kick off on this as well with the Jam, the love of the Jam. So this is before you were known in the music industry, before you were, you know, in the band that was in Haircut 100 and all that. But you love the Jam, didn't you?
I love them right from the beginning. They just resonated. It was like pure electricity for me. The first gig I saw them was the Croydon Greyhound. Must have been 77. Probably. I'd got the album by then. The first sort of heard with them, because I remember just reading and seeing a picture. I think it was like The Picture. I saw the picture of them playing in Carnaby Street, the market near Carnaby Street. It was just like they played in the square there or something. Mm-hmm. And I saw a picture of that and I was smitten. I was always smitten by pictures there. Like, I first saw the picture of Talking Heads in the same way, and they're all wearing Fred Perry's and semi-acoustic guitars. And it was just like, and they, you know, the hair was to one side kind of thing. It was just like, yeah, you know, you latch onto that as somebody that likes to go, because mods love the look, don't they? It goes to the look. And then it's like the music. And if those two things go together, it's just something that happens, isn't it, in that moment. And that was what happened. And then I was working as a commercial artist, and one of the jobs was to deliver a parcel to Chris Parry at Fiction Records. I was really looking forward to that one, you know. So I went there and I waited outside the office, and then out came Chris Parry. I didn't know what he looked like, but it was him. He said, "Okay, son, come in, stick your demo on." And I thought, oh, I said, "I'm just delivering this parcel. It's the Jam artwork, you know, because House of Wizard, the company I worked for then, they did sleeves as well. They used to do Uriah Heep, the Jam."
Oh, what a lovely connection. Brilliant.
So I got to meet Chris Parry there. And then when the band, you know, years later, when I did get a band together, because at that point I thought I could have had a tape. Mm. You know, it was like an inspiration to start making demos, you know, start. That's why I started going to London Bridge and around Elephant and along the St. Catherine's Dock. That was filled with studios, 8-track studios and things. I used to go in there and we just made demos and just wanted to be a band as good as the Jam. I mean, it was all those bands. I mean, they were the benchmark. But, you know, when you're first starting out, you can't play like that. I mean, I just used to look and think, I can see what Paul Weller's doing, but, you know, what is that with his hand? What is he? It took me days to work that out, you know. Jam, 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 jam. Ah, right. So he planned that. Okay. Because he was always doing stuff up here and couldn't afford a Rickenbacker, because even then they were quite expensive. So got a Telecaster. I think that was the first guitar. And then Rob Stroud, he wanted to be a drummer. He was a junior in the art studio too. So together we just walked down to Tin Pan Alley and bought guitars. He bought the drum, the snare drum. I bought a guitar. And then we went back to my house and just in the linen cupboard there and just started playing music. I've just resonated with the Jam somehow out of all those punk bands. I liked The Clash and I loved their first album. It had something for me, but I think it was the songs. And it was the fact that it was, because I wasn't into the Beatles then. I got into them a lot later. I discovered them, but there was there's elements of the Beatles in there, and there's elements of just songwriting, isn't there? And the power, that's what I really liked. I mean, those early clips, what's the one? I think it's In the City. There's an early clip still going round online, a really early gig. It is 100% adrenaline, isn't it? It's just so powerful. The power in the way they move around on stage and everything. And Bruce Falkston diving so high. I mean, he still jumps up that high, doesn't he?
I think he tries, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's still doing it like a gazelle. He's flying through the air like a gazelle. Such an amazing band. I mean, I was fixated on how level Rick Buckler's fringe was as well. It was really level right across, you know. And I tried it one day and I looked like an outpatient, you know. It doesn't suit everybody, does it? You know, you've got to go with your style of hair that you got, you know.
But I like the fact that you're talking about the three of them, right? This isn't the Paul Weller show. The Jam were those three guys. And it's a really important thing. We have talked about this on the podcast, but for you, it was all about the three of them together.
Mm. Yeah, bands, right from seeing the Monkees living together. That was it. It was bands being a band, the myth of that, and how these teams of people were on stage and made magic together. I mean, that was it. I mean, they were the kind of three-headed thing, weren't they? They just like, wow, position one, position two, you know, right in the center, and it's just like so powerful. It's like a pitchfork, They're like digging around the punk atmosphere, like they're digging into the hay and the, you know, the jam with a pitchfork.
So, and from that point, what did you see them often? Were they a band that you saw live a lot?
Yeah, I saw them at the Marquee. Yeah, I saw them quite a few times whenever I could, just regularly whenever they were going. And I bumped into Paul walking down the road in Victoria. It's where the kind of when you walk up to Victoria Station, there's posts that go over this, the modern bit with the shops on the left by sort of like Catholic Church. And I was just walking up there because I lived at that particular point. My parents, who were, we had pubs, and they got a job in the Ski Club of Great Britain, which was 118 Eaton Square. And they got a flat with it. So we were living in the flat in the basement. Found myself up. Punk was kicking off. And I'm just walking around Victoria and all those areas and Belgravia. Believe it or not, it wasn't as posh as it is now. I mean, it's out of the world posh now, but then it was just a place. I mean, I think Paul lived there. He had a Muse house around there. I didn't know that at the time, but I was just seeing him a lot. And I was walking down, and I remember him walking towards me, and he just looked like a kind of, I mean, to me then, it was just, he was a god of pop, you know, in that pop art sense of the word, you know, and he was walking like that. And even then, I don't know why, but I hid on the post. I couldn't face meeting a pop star, so such a person, you know. It was just like he looked so like a god walking down the road. The way he walks as well, he was obviously really aware that he was like, you know.
It's chewing away, yeah. Like,
you know, chewing the gum, yeah. I'm cool. Really cool, and I'm walking down Victoria, you know, and it's obviously a mod sort of guy that, you know, because I was kind of, punk was kicking off, but I was always wore hush puppies. All the way through punk, I was wearing hush puppies because originally I used to wear corduroy shoes, and then that turned into hush puppies. Then it was suede, but the corduroy jacket stayed. So there was just bits. I could never go fully punk. I felt like it was, I don't know. I don't know. But it's a deep connection because I remember my girlfriend left me for a punk. So that might have something to do with it. There might have been a little bit like, well, you know, what do you think of him? The way he dresses, I mean, punk is not cool the way it is. It's dresses. You dress like a bit stupid. I'm sorry. You know, it's like, probably that. And I was into art school bands like Death School and things, and bands that dressed a bit jazz as well. I liked that.
So you had this love of the visual, and you mentioned working in commercial art, graphic design, that type of thing, right? But then this music comes into your life, and you mentioned about the recording in all these little studios, and your mate getting a band together. But before we get to Haircut 100, you went through quite a lot of name changes, didn't you? Didn't you go through quite a lot before you settled on that one?
Yeah, you know, I don't think you're allowed to do that these days because you have to get a web domain going. And
yeah, you're right, yeah.
And I still come up with names now and buy the web name just to sort of like have it, just because I still think I'm going to be starting bands, you know. It's just like, I don't know. It's still the sort of dream is to have a band, about 7 or 8 or maybe 10 or 12 on the go somehow. Maybe that's what I can do here. It's just like, no, I don't want to be in them. That's the thing, though.
You just want to own the rights.
I just like, well, it's for them. I mean, I'd get the band for them because I know bands and I go, listen, guys, you know, you've got to have a great name. That name is not good, what you've got. You know, everything's good, but it's a little adjustment. You're only a few little adjustments about being away from the jam.
Yeah.
100. You know, there are bands with really good names that just, I mean, you know, like Wet Leg, it gets you noticed. It's like that thing you start saying, why? But if you've got a band name like The Something, it just kind of, okay, or it's named after you personally. It's like, okay, that's good, but you know, there's a story, and you know, there's something mythological about bands with really good names as well, and snappy names. And you know, I remember it meant a lot that the Jam were called the Jam. It's a brilliant name, and it writes so well. The artwork around it, the sprayed on the wall. I mean, I've been to the exhibition 3 times now, and it's just every time you go to the tiles. And you see that, that's a really strong look, isn't it? And logo, the Jam, you know, for hours I used to sit there drawing that, you know. So, you know, when you start a band, you just think, well, there's no way I would have a crap name. So you go through your crap names a lot. You know, we went through many crap names.
Yeah, what do we have? So we had Rugby, The Boat Party was one, I think.
We played at the Wellington Waterloo under Rugby. You know, I thought Rugby was a good name. I thought it was, you know.
Captain Pennyworth, that was another one, wasn't it?
Yeah, Napkin Man. That was great.
I didn't know that one.
Yeah. Crispy cereals. See, all good crap names going nowhere. Yeah.
We land on Haircut 100, and I mean, this thing goes massive, huge sales, some amazing singles. Like I say, we're like 40 years on, and these things still stand up when we talk about, you know, Nobody's Fool and Favorite Shirts and this debut album. We'll talk more about that debut album in a second as well, because there is a big celebration this year with that album. Massive, massive sales. You mentioned about it being chaotic the last week or so. I mean, how chaotic was that at the time? I mean, must have been huge, exciting, but pretty intense, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was. And I'd pogoed, I'd done stuff in the audience as watching and mythologizing it and stuff. And it was the dream, standing in the audience of the Greyhounds, like looking at the Jam and just, you know, sweating as they did. I thought, I want to be on stage sweating like that. And then go forward many years and it's happening to you. You know, you're learning about all the things that also go beyond. And, you know, you always think it's what's happening is just happening. And nobody else has been through this. But, you know, as you get older, you realize that most bands go through the same stuff, the same pitfalls, same things they've got to work on. And we went through them all. You know, the manager that sort of sets you up and then walks off with all the money from the merchandising, does a runner. You know, you go through all that stuff of everybody trying to manage the band, and then same old stuff, the jealousies in the band that starts to happen, all the insecurities, the immaturity. I went through kind of not being able to handle the level of fame. I mean, I know I wanted it. You know, I had sat and watched Stardust, you know, watching that as a kid going, wow. But then when it does happen, you dream about it. But when it does happen, it's more real and you actually have to deal with it in real time. And all the emotions, and you're not equipped to deal with it. Well, some people are, some people aren't, but it went totally to our heads. We thought we understood it. Everything was good, but only in hindsight, we just went, well, what a pig's ear of that. You know, what we made. You know,
I wonder if now that also there are more support networks in place and people like, do you know what I mean? Like the management would be able to coach a Harry Styles or Ed Sheeran on that level of fame. And because you've got all that knowledge now. But yeah. Back then, people were winging it, weren't they? You know, you were kind of all making up as you went along, really. So you didn't have that kind of mechanism where you could support young artists in that way.
No, it's really together now, actually. I mean, I still think that rock and roll stuff does happen, and there are not such great people out there taking advantage of naive people in that, you know, there's still that stuff that goes on. But generally, I think it's got better and better. It's like everything's got better that way, you know. As it gets better, it gets worse, and as it gets worse, it gets better sometimes, you know, because it takes away all that randomness. I mean, I did an interview the other day, and I said jokingly, which is always kind of something said in jest, but I said, you know, maybe if we hadn't have been so, if it's a free-for-all and sort of ripped off, if you like, for want of a better description, if it hadn't have been like that, maybe we wouldn't have happened, because we had to be so open and for everything to take off. You've got to sort of like not be in control. It's just that we didn't have that point where it was suddenly, you know, we didn't have like John, the Jam's manager, you know, we didn't have that. We didn't have that strong guidance. So yes, it went like that. And it's a bit like an aeroplane. Yeah. But you know, if the crew don't know how to fly this plane,
yeah, it's soon going to come crashing down, right? Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, even a ship doesn't get too far outside of the harbour, even if it wants to go around the world.
There are a few lovely little Weller connections I wanted to link in on, right? So, and I mentioned on Twitter that we were chatting, and lots of people have got in touch with questions. So I must get through some of these as well. So AK on Twitter said, ask him who thought up the early Haircut 100 image, chunky jumpers tucked into pantaloons. Now, I think there's a link to the Jam around some of this stuff as well, in terms of the visual element of the band. Was it Brian Morrison? Wasn't there a story with Brian? He was links with you, yeah. And also with the Jam, right?
Yeah. That's another thing, you know, it was those sort of pinch me moments, kind of like growing up loving the Jam, having this sort of Chris Parry connection, who then did actually want, he came to one of the early gigs. So we could have signed to Fiction, but it was actually Arista that we went with because of also the love of the beat, how their pop records sounded and so crisp and things, and a kind of thing of they had the Monkees, you know, kind of thing. But it could have been. Sorry, I've went off and I started thinking of.
I love it. The memories all going back.
I think it's because I didn't sleep.
I was mentioning about Brian Morrison because he was your publisher as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, Brian Morrison. He was, and that was a pinch me moment because, you know, the first publisher that gets involved is the guy that signed The Jam. And it's kind of like, oh my God, The Jam? He said, when I talked to Brian, he said, yeah, he had a big cigar kind of thing. He was a real white boy, larger than life character, big furry coat, flew a helicopter, drove a sort of getaway Jag kind of thing, or Aston Martin with his partner Dick. You know, Dick Leahy, bless him, he's not with us now. He said, I just wanted Paul Weller, you, and George Michael. So it was a huge in that way. Another thing is that connection. And then I remember Bruce being on Arista for a while, but actually after The Jam as well.
That's right. As a solo artist, wasn't he? Yeah. So your label mates.
Yeah, because he was with Brian as well. So I got to meet Bruce a bit. But Bruce is really shy. I mean, I played with From The Jam a few times and he's really shy. You know, you think somebody, I mean, I kind of, you know, again, being back at the Greyhound, you think that gazelle up there is really confident. That confident gazelle, it's like Penelope Pitstop. Surely Penelope Pitstop is not quiet. And then you meet Penelope and it's just like, you know, he's very quiet, very private. It's a strange one.
What was Brian's involvement in the image? Didn't he have something to do with how you looked? Was that a Top of the Pops thing or something?
Yeah, he came down to the Top of the Pops studio for the run through, and he was watching the run through, and it was freezing in there, absolutely freezing. So we just had our jumpers on, jumpers tied around the necks. We weren't gonna wear that, we're gonna just, I think it was like at that particular point, I was going to wear full polo gear and everyone else was going to wear like Converse, because that's what we were into. And Les wanted to wear a bit more smart because he used to go for kind of distinguished gent kind of look, because he really liked film stars, I think. He's got a bit of a dashing film star suave look going even today. It's just like, you know, Les, you look really suave, if you don't mind me saying, you know, sophisticated. He's just got that way about him. He's got a cool dress sense, Les. He can make Zara look good. Yeah, and so that's what we're doing. And Brian said, boys, keep the jumpers on. So we did. We listened to our publisher, you know, kept the jumpers on. And that was another one of those happy accidents, like a kind of organic thing. It went crazy because of wearing jumpers.
Why not? Now, there's some other little connections we're going to talk about as well, right? So the album cover, you were involved, obviously the commercial artistry of you was involved heavily in the design of that. But am I right in thinking Gerard Mankiewicz was the photographer? The Modern World, The Jam photo, and Gerard's been on the podcast as well, but there's a little Jam connection there. Was that obvious? Did you pick it from that reason, or is it just happy coincidence?
Happy coincidence again, and one of the pinch me kind of stuff that was happening one after the other, you know. And also you're starting to develop this thing where you pinch me and you can't believe it's happening, but also you get a feeling of, am I worthy of this? Because you feel like you say I'm a fraud,
that imposter syndrome type
yeah.
thing. Really?
Yeah, I think everybody, well, not everybody, I can't speak for everybody, but you come across it so much just in anything. I think it's anybody as well that is dealing with having success. There's a part of you that thinks, why me? In a way. Maybe it's connected closely to survivors of accidents. You know, like, you know, they have that moment where they feel guilty about surviving, but it's something psychologically going on there where you know, because you don't want to, you don't want to feel like that, but obviously, but it is actually happening. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with a running commentary when here you are at an award ceremony and you're chatting and you're going up and you see Sting coming towards you? You know, and it's just like, I mean, yeah, it wasn't that long before I was diving out the way of Paul Weller walking down the street. Yeah. And I wasn't even known. It was just like, what on earth am I doing diving out the way? What is this? This is strange. Why am I diving? What am I? You know, and then you got kind of Sting coming towards you and he comes over and goes, yo, you know, he didn't, but I can't remember what he said. But but yeah, it's just a bit like, and you're talking to them going, there's a part of you that's going, you know.
Yeah, you shouldn't be here. This is not, yeah, I understand what you're saying. And I guess then it also plays into maybe sometimes that visualizes itself to that destructiveness. And maybe that's when the band implodes, and we'll talk about
that. Yeah, I think we're all dealing with that. You're self-destructing all the time. And I think nowadays they even recognize it, and they have managers to help artists not self-sabotage. You know, you see it in bands now, you know. There are people in bands that are, you know, you can see them, that some of them are just at it and others just born to being social butterflies. Mm-hmm. They're taken to it like a duck to water. You know, but you look at even Harry Styles getting an award and sort of, there he gets a Grammy and he goes, you know, people like me shouldn't.
Yeah, I know.
What he was meaning. He wasn't saying, because he didn't probably obviously see himself as white, privileged, wealthy bloke. He just says people like me from a boy band shouldn't be getting an award like this. This is for Prince or something. So even then he's probably got that. At that level, he's got that imposter syndrome where he's thinking, you know, people like me. And I mean, it's that thing of insecurity, you know. I was probably standing there with Sting going, having grown up with him, thinking, well, you're in Quadrophenia, you're the face, you know, you are that guy. Look at you, you know, look at you're Sting, for God's sake. You know, I'm some oik from Beckenham. I just know G minor, D, C, F, maybe, you know. Few others, and I've fitted them around and made pop songs, and I've looked at Paul Weller going, da-na-na-na-na. That's the thing. I'm not a jazz, but I don't know. So you've got that, which is kind of ego, really, egocentric and insecurity, because you can learn. You can learn if you want to learn that stuff, and the better you get, the more confident you get in certain areas. And anyway, it's not a competition. It's better to be your best self, but I didn't know that then. If I got that interrogation, it feels like now from myself, because it's no one else, it's you, the inner voice. And now I just laugh at it and say, you know, because I still get it sometimes on an aircraft, you know, it's going to crash. It's like, I just mark it unhelpful thought.
Yeah, you're able to manage it and stuff. I get that. Totally. Now, look, there's a few other Weller things I need to talk about, right? Let's talk about Love Plus One, okay? So the lyric, where does it go from here? Is it down to the lake I fear? Didn't Mr. Weller have an issue with that?
Did he?
Oh, I heard this. I thought he took you to task for that lyric, I heard.
Well, he was always taking me to task for something. You know, he didn't like my boots at one point. Well, what you wearing? Oh, he always too high. You know, we're in the Legends, I think it was. And I must say he was in a really, he was at Star Council, he has some early days there. It was probably about 83 or something. And he had some really cool shoes on. They were nice and flat. And I think I was wearing a bit of a high heel and he didn't like that. You know, I think he saw me as, you know, somebody that should be cooler than that. You know, what are you doing in those high heels? And I must say, I did agree with him. You know, there's that thing. I did look like down and I thought, well, I'm not actually as tall as you, Paul. You can get away with flat. You know, I must be going through a stage where I want to be taller, you know.
Paul Fitzgibbon on Twitter said, I saw a secret Style Council gig under the alias The Party Chambers Group at the Shaw Theatre in London. Nick was there with Paul Weller in the bar, right next to us all before the gig. Terence Trent D'Arby supported the Style Council. Kamel Hines' band played the last set. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing. I got on really well with Paul. We used to rib each other. But it was out of respect. When Les and I we went on Gary Crowley's show and did an impersonation of Paul on the front of the NME. What's all that about then? With your lots of paint on and hardly any clothes on. What's all that about, Paul? And it's like that thing of it was reverence. It's that thing when you love someone so much, you feel as though you can. Because somebody that doesn't care, they're not on their radar. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, when you love a band or when you love artists and stuff, you support them in that way. That ribbing goes hand in hand, doesn't it? It's a kind of English thing, maybe, or something. Ribbing each other is about being part of mates, isn't it? And now, I know Nicky Weller, and I have a fondness for the family, and, you know, I do some charity stuff with Nicky and things, and, you know, I would drop anything to do sort of like something to do with that, and that respect there.
Yeah, I gather I think it's also a bit of a Weller trait, the kind of piss taking and stuff like that. Yeah, exactly. If they're taking the piss out of you, you're on good ground, you know.
Yeah. And I hang out all the time, and I'm still a bit good friends with Simon Halfen, who did most of the, you know, sleeves and things and stuff. So I just had, you just end up meeting, you know, of course I'd end up working with Simon, you know, it's a group of people, you know, when you meet Paolo Hewitt for the first time, it's a bit like his reputation comes with him. It's just like, wow, you know. It's Paolo Hewitt, the bag, the whole thing. Suddenly, zoop, and you go, yeah, you know, it's the game. Let's drink some cappuccino. Let's do it now, you know.
I love the fact that that's all coming across of you being a really big fan as well, but being part of this world, I kind of understand the idea of this, like you thinking you don't deserve to be part of it. Sean Farrell actually mentioned about he called it slagging off, I think, but let's call it this rivalry and this kind of mickey taking or whatever. But apparently there was one bit, I don't know if you remember this, Paul said he'd like to be in one of your videos sitting on a tractor or eating a bar of chocolate. He said, did any of this stuff ever bother you? And when did you bury the hatchet? But it sounded like actually this is all just kind of fun.
It was a lovely ribbon between each other. Yeah. Cause yeah. I mean, I even just not so long ago, it must have been about 5 years ago. I was just walking down the street. It was summer. It was now around the Edgware Road. I'm just crossing the road and Minnie pulls up to turn out, and it was Paul. Window comes down. Oi! You know, what you doing here? You know, kind of thing. And we hadn't seen each other for, must have been about 10 years or something like that, maybe longer. And it was just a lovely feeling. It was just, you know, just lovely, just nice. And we, you know, we send our regards to each other via Nikki and things. And it's just, it's really good. It's just he knows I love the band. I mean, it's, you know, and he knows I love him as a songwriter. I mean, he's brilliant. But, you know, I respect everyone in that band because, you know, once you fall in love with a band, that's it. I feel it's like your loyalty to them as a band and a brand. You know, I'll be a Jam fan until the day I die. You know, it's just kind of, I'll keep going to the exhibitions, whatever the next one is. Cause it seems like there's like a load of stuff probably that we haven't seen. And it's just, there's more stuff to come on and I'll always want to see it.
Yeah. I love seeing all that. I mean, what Nikki does with those exhibitions is incredible.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
But you also love doing a bit of a Jam cover version on occasion on stage. So I know Pretty Green's been in the set list occasionally. But
yeah, and Sounds from the Street is one of my favourite songs.
Yeah, quite a few people have mentioned that actually, of you seeing you do that. And Captain Stack said your live TV performance of that song has always been one of his absolute favourite Jam covers ever.
Oh, wow.
And he also said, here's a good question actually, he said, is there a song of yours that you'd like to be interpreted by Paul in his own way? A weller version of one of your songs?
By the way, that thing with the tractor still could happen. You know, the band is back and Paul is still here, we're all still here, you know, and I think he would suit being a farmer on a tractor more now than ever,
eating the bar of chocolate, the flake, yeah. Chocolate flake, yeah. Do you reckon Paul would play one of your songs? Is there a song of yours that you'd love to hear him do a version
of? He's tricky, you know, I mean, getting him to do anything, you know, I'm not sure, it would maybe if he mellows out a bit. You know, even more, I mean, he's getting more mellow and more yellow as the years go on. I've known people that knew him as well, my friend Lisa and Steve out in LA, and she worked on K-Rock and stuff and known him years, and when they met, you know, Paul came over and just picked her up and almost threw her in the air. Lisa, whoa, you know, I mean, he's just become more and more like a loving thing and loving, embracing thing. I mean, he's just done everything so beautifully, I think, so well. His tenacity, his attention to just the love of music, and he just gets out there, gets on tour, and goes and does it. There's a clear template every year, isn't it? I'm touring, I'm doing another record, I've got the barn, we make music, Steve Craddock's here, he keeps writing these brilliant songs and it keeps sounding great, and every once in a while you'll just go like, that's brilliant, that's a really good one. And it's very simple, it's just, you know, he's just, I'm a songwriter, I love a band, I love playing music, and I love touring. So that's what I do. And the music business has changed, gone through all this stuff around him, but he's still been just doing that one thing. That's, I think having John there at the beginning really helped guide him through the tricky part of your career, you know, because he's now so up and running that really it's just, I don't think he's sort of like need management, if you will. He's so aware of what his appeal is and what he needs to do and what he doesn't want to do. I've always really admired the fact that he knows what he doesn't want to do. It's harder sometimes, people pleasing. You know, I'd love to be like Paul in that way, uncompromising like that. But if you come from another place. Sometimes being amenable can be a downfall, being, you know, pleasing people in that way. So not everybody's born that way, but I admire that in him. But, you know, you find that through, I had to find that through learning, really. I like that about Noel Gallagher as well. He's uncompromising. You know, there's a fine line between that and then being stubborn, you know, not being open and open to stuff. I mean, you know, had I been so much like that, we wouldn't know. I wouldn't be feeling the joy that I'm feeling now of being in what I consider to be the best band in the world. You know, I've got that feeling. I've got that feeling now to be in the best band in the world. I mean, it's like we're in there and just the love in the room. And to get that at 61, to be in love with your band, feel and know that you're the best band at that age, it's like the best thing.
Let's talk about Pelican West, Haircut 100's debut album, and the 40th anniversary. And it was that anniversary that brought about this reissue. And through doing this podcast, I've got back into vinyl again. Like, and so many people are back into the vinyl again, right? Mm. And I made a little pact with myself that when people were on the podcast, I'd start building up the vinyl with the people and kind of build up a bit of a collection for my kids as well, right? So the fact that we're back with Pelican West reissued, back on vinyl with, I mean, I don't know how many discs this is, we're going to say the amount of stuff on there's incredible. And this wonderful, beautiful 40th anniversary celebration edition is out right now. It's just been released. And the fact that people are re-embracing this wonderful album, but we're also getting the B-sides, remixes, rarities, all this stuff. I'm guessing initially that was just the project to reissue the album. Then suddenly we've got a live date coming up in the summer where the Radio 2 stuff, there's Record Store Day stuff coming. It's building, building, building. And is the band back together? It's like, this is now a thing.
Yeah. Again, that wasn't planned. It wasn't planned. We knew that there was the 40th year is coming up. So we all obviously just knew. And it's that thing of it's coming up. And Demon, who brilliant to work with. Everyone there, Julian, Ben, fantastic. And Daryl Eastley has put it together. Esler. I've got to have a word with Daryl about that. It's like I keep going from one to another. It's like I'm playing ping pong with his surname. Eastley Esler, you know, I've got to have a sit down and chat about that, you know, because he's putting this whole thing together and through his love. So I think the foundations are strong here because it's the love of Pelican West. It's the love of Haircut 100. So I think that love is definitely lifting it now. I was just backstage at one of these Let's Rock gig chatting to somebody because Kilimanjaro had just taken over Let's Rock, who are promoters. They just bought it and talking to Joff. I said, if Haircut played a gig, where would you put it on? And he went, Shippers Bush Empire, that'd be a really good place. I said, okay. Well, see what happens. I said, actually, do you think just do it? He said, if you're serious about it. So I thought, oh, God, I've got to talk to everyone. I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know if, you know. But I just said, yes. I just said, like, go for it. But then he left. And then it was just left there. And I thought, oh, well, that won't happen then. Oh, that's a shame. But that's okay. It's not meant to happen. And then Steve from Kilimanjaro said, hey, you up for that Haircut gig? And by then, you know, things would sort of, I think, Demon Records had put some more together. And I just said, yes, go for it. I thought, oh, God. I said, I have no idea whether anybody's interested in it, but it's going to happen. I've got the faith in it. And he went, well, it's going to cost me to hire the place. It's going to cost, you know, I'm like, just do it. Okay. I thought to myself, I will pay for this if nothing happens. And so started communicating, did some interviews with each other and stuff like that. And none of us knew whether we're talking about the past and the reverence. And it's just nice to have this thing happening. And, you know, because you've got all your stuff and, you know, different levels in your life where you're at and things. Last I'd heard, Phil was completely retired from music. So, you know, you just assume, oh, okay, nobody's going to be wanting to get on stage so much. But, yeah, you never know. You know, there's modern things today, modern techniques. You know, you can do anything on stage now. You can be a hologram. You know,
I was going to say, we could turn him into an avatar. Right?
You can do that, but it's just whether you're ready or up for it. So it got to the point where we were emailing each other and stuff, and we didn't get a reply about the gig from a couple of guys. And I said, let's have a meeting, bring everything up to date. We can just bring it all up to date and see whether there's any kind of like future. And it was funny because couple didn't turn up to the, didn't reply about the gig and turn up to it, to the meeting. But, you know, Les came all the way from Spain. Graham drove up from Cornwall and Blair came over from Chiswick. Right. Actually, Blair wasn't there at the initial thing, but, you know, he was just like, I'm in, you know, the sticks. Blair and I are really close. Kind of thing. So,
and I guess there's an element where without them, it's not the band, right?
Les and Graham, I mean, it was our dream, Haircut 100. You know, we sat around the coffee table every Friday to get another band name together to go to the Three Tons pub in Beckenham to try it out on our mates. We all got chucked by our girlfriends in the same week. We rehearsed together in the linen cupboard. We lived above a flower shop in Gloucester Road together. We lived and breathed the dream of Haircut 100. It was our band. We are the founding fathers of the band. It was us living our dream. So without that, the three-headed jam pitchfork, you know, it's like it doesn't work. I mean, as soon as that was separated originally, that was the split in the band because that was the strong prong. And so once the strong prong was back, it was like, you know, like we're on here. We feel the love, you know. It's like you do the strong prong, turn it around like this, you know, or whatever that heart thing that people do. So that's it. And the love is there like it's never been before. Well, there was love there before, but it was young love. I mean, sometimes reunions don't work so well, as we've all found out, you know, on Facebook, yeah. Stuff like that. It's like, there was a reason.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not mates anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, not all of it works. Not all, you know, there were six of us, so it's not going to work. But it, you know, didn't make the first bit, you know. I think a couple of guys wanted to just keep it, the issues in the past and with them, and obviously not want to bring it up to date. So that's fine. That's, you know, you've got to respect their decision. But that meeting was fantastic, and it's been lovely since. So, yes, there is a past, and everybody was part of that past to make it happen. But, you know, not everybody wants to be, is ready to be future, you know.
Well, look, and that gig goes on sale, 12th of May, Shepherd's Bush Empire, and just sold out like that, right? It's like, done.
I mean, that was another surprise. It took the promoters by surprise, you know, because it was a bit like, because I said, wouldn't it be great if we could do a tour like straight away? And I was really enthusiastic. Like, now let's see how the gig goes at Shepherd's Bush, but it's sold out. So, which is, that didn't happen when we sort of had the last attempt we did to kind of get together. This is right though. It's just, we just know it's right. I mean, we've already agreed this is for life now. This is, we're going to grow old together, you know, as mates, even if we have a cafe. It's going to be, we're going to be going to each other's funerals.
Well, look, I mean, we've not even touched on the solo stuff. So you're going to, are we putting the solo thing on hold for a little bit while we're back with the band, or is it kind of
the band is always together now. So it's just back. So we do concept jazz solo albums and I do jazz solo pop. Whatever it is, it's just like the band is always together.
It'll exist at the same time.
We can all do our solo thing. So, and that's just the fact that I love writing songs and, hey, I might have other bands. You know, we all might have other bands, you know. Who knows? You know, it's just, but Haircut 100 is back. We're good.
One of the things that came up in research, don't know if you can confirm for me, obviously you mentioned the Style Council earlier on and loving that band as well. But Mr. Mick Talbot, this came up in research, Boogie Box High, Jive Talking. So it's never been confirmed on anything, but it was George Michael, Mick Talbot rumoured, and you. Can you clear this up?
Yeah, I played guitar on that.
You did?
No, and that is George singing.
And Mick Talbot in the room.
Yeah, it was... We made it a solid bond.
How did that come about?
Just fun. I think it was Simon Halfen for me. You know, he was something to do with it. And it was George's cousin, I think, as well, was involved in it. I went along, I played and never got paid. Never earned a penny out of that thing.
Then it got to number one, didn't it?
Yeah, number one I played on, and oh well, there you
bugger
go.
All. Oh man,
I don't mind. And of course, in the pop history thing, and at the time I was thinking, yeah, I wonder what happened to that. But that, it was just a nice rock and roll thing to do. One of my favourite songs, Jive Talking.
Yeah, great. I love that. Oh, I'm glad we cleared that up. Now, one other thing I came across in research, which I haven't managed to find anywhere else, this may be complete nonsense, but it said that you toured with Paul in support of one of your solo albums, 1993. From Monday to Sunday was the album. It said you were on tour with Paul, but is that true? Is that right?
No, I'd remember that if it was.
I thought it was.
I did play with Paul in New York. It was Teenage Fan Club, Catherine Will, myself and Paul in a tiny little club in Buffalo, like a punk club. Paul had flown in Concorde which I was ribbing about. And I was saying, you flew Concorde to be here. In this like, club in the middle of nowhere, upstate New York. I was going, that's cool. Or, you know, early 90s, about 93. So we wanted to do a song, and he wanted to do, he suggested That's Entertainment. But I just didn't know it off the top of my head like that. Of course, I knew the song, you know, and in love with the song, but it just, I thought, oh God. And, you know, I'm not great at just like going and learning it. You know, there wasn't phones around to Google the lyrics or this or that. This was backstage kind of thing. So we did Dr. Robert that we both knew together, Beatles. And I had this thing where it was like, there we were with our acoustics, because it was a bit of an acoustic gig, playing along like that, you know, going, ring my bell, I said you called Dr. Robert. And the mic was slowly going down like this. And lower and lower. But I thought, I'm singing with fucking Paul Weller. The mic stand is not going to fuck up this period. Like, in the end, it was just like I disappeared. You know, I think it was like, you know, hi, yeah. You know, that was it. It was my magic moment was ruined by the mic stand. But it was a moment, and I got to play with Paul. So I have done it, you know. I've gigged with him for 3 minutes. And I've been on stage with Bruce. Yeah, I played in Paul's position.
Oh, yeah, this was on stage with Russell Hastings and Bruce Foxton from The Jam, yeah?
I can see how Russell puts, I don't know how he puts it, mentally gets his head around this. He had to turn around and see Bruce Foxton. It's a kind of like, that was a moment that, you know, to be, you know, to think about it, like to be a kid in Plimsolls, you know, and looking up at The Jam at the Croydon Greyhound and wanting to be there, you know, so much like, wow, the reverence of it. And then many years later to be on stage, I think it was like an arena as well in Manchester or Liverpool. No, was it Liverpool?
Yes, it was the Liverpool Echo, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. Oh, big place as well, you know, in front of all those Jam fans. And it's like, that's hard because I'm a Jam fan, but, you know, there was probably somebody in quite a few people in the audience going, I'm not happy with this.
Yeah.
I'm not happy with this. But, you know, this is the thing, is the respect to the band and the songs. That's what I was there for. Bandy Joy and Boy, the same. You know, we were all there to just sing these classics. He did English Rose, I think, beautifully. Yeah.
That was his celebration of the Jam, the concert at the end of the exhibition up in Liverpool, wasn't it? That was 2016, yeah?
Yeah.
Wonderful, yeah.
So it was just a, God, I mean, I'm in that position. Oh, my God, it's, like, amazing. I thought I jumped on stage with From the Jam, a Let's Rock kind of thing. It was summer, and it was, you know, they're on stage, and they're absolutely brilliant, and I just jumped on. Really weird, I got taken over by the whole, like, essence of punk.
You go properly with it.
Mic like Iggy Pop, and it was just a bit of a moment, and I got a bit aggressive with the mic stand. I was like flinging it in the end, and it was like fell over. First time in my career I've ever thrown a mic stand over, you know. It's like I was overwhelmed by the whole spirit of punk.
Ripping your top off.
Yeah.
Iggy Pop style, yeah.
Come on, you fuckers. Sorry. He's really abusive to his audience, isn't he, Iggy Pop? In a fond way. We're back to that fondness, you know. He loves his audience so much. They love him that they don't mind being sworn at.
Yeah, people are paying to be sworn at.
Yeah, so. I mean, I went to see him in Japan, I think, and it was the night before we were playing at this place. And so they said, do you want to come and see Iggy Pop? And I was like, yeah. Went there, and I was shocked. It was like, he came on stage and said, you know, it was like, and they were going, yeah, you know. And I thought, hold on, man, there's this guy up on stage calling me a wanker. It's just like...
I want to also mention Woodland Echoes before we go. So this was, I mean, a little while back, but your most recent solo album, because it's just beautiful. It's just a stunning piece of work, man. Honestly, it's so uplifting. And it's not lovely listening to it this time of year, right? So we're in winter at the minute. It's cold. It's horrible. But you listen to it and it just screams sunshine out of you. And it's just, it's a lovely, lovely thing, man. But that took a while to put together, didn't it? It's not easy making a record these days like it was back in the day.
No, there was no budget for it. So I was, you know, paying for it as I went. So it was a bit like, okay, there's some money. And then there wasn't that kind of, okay, there's some money, so go in with, you know, top class studio with a, there wasn't a producer and things. So it came together by happy accidents anyway. And it was lovely to work with my son, who was helping out with that. So it's probably why it's so sunshiny, because you're working with your son. It's like,
yeah,
the sun is out. Also going up to see my wife's parents who live in Tampa and then Florida. And then from Florida, we went down to see my mate who moved to Key West, right at the tip of America, you know, 90 miles from Cuba. My friend Ian Shaw, who'd I'd done all the early sort of demos with, and Kite, a song called Kite, I did the recording with him for that, and it had a bit of something magical about it, and that ended up being the record. Recorded that there in a basement in Shaw's Road in Fulham, and it was moss. It was just so damp down there, you know, and he was down there for years, and then he moves to Key West to build his houseboat, and he's living on a boat there. He has his little studio down there. So we ended up going down to see him. And it was that thing of, okay, we're here. Why don't we record? Go back to what we know, do it. And that's when I did this song called Mountaintop.
I love that. That's a lovely song, man.
It's kind of weird kind of style for me because I've never done that kind of rhythm or anything. And to be on sea level and write a song about being high on a mountaintop was strange. But it was, I was kind of thinking of, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. When Robert Donut discovers love, calling on a mountaintop.
Right, yeah.
It's that thing, well, through the mist, and they get lost, don't they? And it's just, and that film really meant something to me. Yes, I'd remembered it from being younger, and you know, Sunday afternoon, parents are out. Goodbye, Mr. Chips is on the telly, and you're watching it, and it's something to watch because you know it's raining or something like that. But now it became a film. It resonated with me because when my parents died, I couldn't get my head around it at all. I thought I was grieving properly, but I wasn't. I couldn't cry, and I didn't know why, and didn't cry for a year, and then it got to 2 years, and I started getting ill, and then I watched Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and I couldn't stop bawling my every moment. It was just getting to me. This film, this whole black and white film with Robert Donut, was working, and it wasn't like I could be in denial of this film and say, oh no, you know. But then when the straw breaks the camel's back, finally go. And then that was it, Niagara Falls kind of. And so this song is I can hold dear. I feel even just talking about it. It was a brilliant moment. And so that film meant a lot. So that's what I'm in Love on a Mountaintop is a kind of the celebration of life, because you discover it via letting go. You know, it's what you let go of. And even look at that with haircut, you know, we all let go. I mean, Les said, I just let it all go, Nick. And you can tell, because meeting Les, when somebody's let it all go and you meet, your issues have gone.
Yeah, it's not relevant, right? Yeah.
No. Yeah. And even if it is relevant and you can talk about it over a drink or something or other at some point, it doesn't matter. Actual genuine issue. You can still get on with stuff, but it's just there. It's not the block. It's not a block. It's not the reason you're really angry or not doing something. You know, that fist, when it's kind of like just more like a wave. It's not such a fist anymore, is it? You know?
Oh man, you're getting me going now, Nick. Honestly, I have to ask you one other question, actually, from one of the fans on Twitter. So Dave Ross, he went to the night where you and Gary Crowley had a lovely conversation. Sadly, I missed this because I love Gary. He's absolute legend, and he's been on the podcast. He's brilliant.
Legend, lovely man.
What a fella! But he said it was a great night out, and as always, Nick was full of great stories. Ask him about his first interview with Adrian Thrills, and you won't be disappointed with the story.
Oh,
so sorry to get you just to tell a story, man, but apparently this is well worth it, folks.
I used to work in Great Marlborough Street in House of Wizard, the commercial art company. That's when we lived above a flower shop in Kensington and Gloucester Road. And so I'd go to work, and I thought, well, the New Musical Express is in Carnaby Street. Well, that's really close. You know, so lunchtime, I just thought, I'll get off a little bit earlier, so not everybody's out to lunch in the NME, and I'm just going to go there. So I walked it. Because I used to walk past all the time, you know, because I'd always go to Carnaby Street just to walk up and down anyway. You know, when you don't need to cut through Carnaby Street, but you just go, I'm going to go through Carnaby Street. Because I've walked up and down Carnaby Street with my mum many a time, you know, getting Lord Kitchener shirts, T-shirts, making bacon, you know, flared sleeves like this. So I was walking, and I just thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going in. I'm walking into the NME. Oh, going up the stairs. I'm going in, and I walked in, and it was just like, oh my God, there's desks everywhere. Oh, this is too real. And I went, that's the guy from the Specials documentary, the Scar documentary. That's, you know, that, oh my, that's the picture I reckon the singles reviews, you know. There's Adrian Thrill, and I sat down and it's kind of like that thing of, oh, yeah, can I help you kind of thing? I said, yeah, I'm from a band, you know, and as you can see his face, you know. Yeah. You know, and I had his music
And
I said we're called Haircut 100, and you could just tell just from that that's how important a name is. Because I don't think he kicked me out because it's just like, what? You know, it's that thing of why, what? Haircut 100. I gave him a tape which had a load of jamming on it because we did a the tape was not very good, and he laughed about it because, you know, he played it and it was just like, hold on a minute, what's this? There's a over it and stuff. It's like a sort of jazz thing. We were just going like a Gary Burton thing. And I was going, oh, let me read my poem. Yeah. And Graham's going, yeah, yeah. It's a, we're just kind of, Les was with this bottle. He was banging this bottle. And
is this one of the bonus tracks on the box set?
I can get hold of that. It is around. We got a load of demos somehow up here through not such great experiences. I think somebody died, you know, and their garage kind of got given to eBay. And then it was just, there they are, you know. We had somebody, Dave Bottrell, who just used to just collect our stuff. I mean, he loved the band so much and ended up managing me for a while. And he's a lovely guy. And yeah, he's not with us now. But anyway, I digress. Adrian sat down. And then from that, he came around with a guy with a camera to our flat above the florists. Well, the flower shop, took some pictures, had a little chat, and we just thought that wasn't an interview or anything. Anyway, it appeared in the Enemy as a half-page spread, and that was it. That was the moment. That was like the change from then. That's the moment. It literally went like suddenly like this. We played up the road at the college, and that's where Chris Parry couldn't get in. The place was round, and we were supporting a band called the Tropicanos, who were kind of Calypso bands, and Lascelles and Herschel in the brass section ended up being in our brass from that gig. They're in the band, and they were kind of going, you know, you guys, you got a lot of fans.
That thing of the power of the music press as well, just that one thing in Enemy, and suddenly it takes off.
Yeah. Honestly, any young bands listening to this, it's like, bold move.
Yeah.
But if you think, this was this kind of the contradiction between being insecure and bold at the same time. You know, it's those things of bold moves can bring amazing results and magical stuff. You just got to make the move on that.
Yeah, yeah. That's fabulous, man. Hey, look, Nick, I've loved chatting with you. Good luck with everything that's happening right now. Having the band back, deserve all this success, man. It's going to be really exciting to see what's next. And a new material, I'm sure, will be talked about at some point as well, right?
I don't see why Haircut 100 can't have a number one album again, because we didn't do it last time. It's number two.
Right.
I think the German kept us off.
I have two final questions for you before you go, Nick. Okay, so you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or it can be Paul Weller solo. What are you gonna go with?
I think In the City. What a song. It's still, you know, oh no, this is the modern world.
He's not even a fan, folks.
Look at that. If I had time to think about it, I'd probably come up with a long list, and I'd go through it many times, and I'd come up with one. I must say, right from the early things, Away from the Numbers really resonated. That was that's where I fell in love, Away from the Numbers.
That was the one that Russell chose, I think, Russell Hastings.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe it's everybody's first port of call, because it's so soft for them as well, because it was it was like the strawberry jam in a donut, that moment in this album. You know, because you said stuff that went out the clappers, like Art School and things, you know.
And Batman and all that, yeah.
I loved it. It was, for me, it was just like, this was pop art at its best, you know. Because when I got into The Who, they'd already stopped being what I liked about them, you know. Because I felt like it was still pop art when they were doing I Can See for Miles and stuff, and the whole kind of Tommy thing I loved. And it used to be in the Beans and everywhere. And it's just like, wow, this is it. I mean, I had a can of baked beans on the sleeve in the 90s, but just purely because of that. It was baked beans means pop. That's what it is. It's
is that why you wrote the song, mate? It's because of that.
Probably. You know, I mean, I wanted that. I was just such a fan of pop art, and it was just like, here's a song, and it's called Baked Beans. And the fact that it was called Baked Bean really, really, really messed
Have you corrected that on the reissue?
Yes. Yeah. It's plural. It's what it was meant to be. It was a typo all those years. It was. I just thought, Baked Bean. Oh, my God. So wrong. There's not a song called Baked Bean. Whoa, it's Baked Beans. It's not pop art. It's not one. It's not one Baked Bean. It's thousands of the fuckers.
Now, Nick, final question.
That's not a meal. No.
Final question, right? So the purpose of this podcast is to meet amazing people like yourself who love the well of music, the Jam, the Style Council, whatever, and have all these connections. But really, it's to dig into your career, hear your story as well. So I'd love this. But it's for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed in my radio career, right? So if it happens at the end of this podcast series, Nick, what should I ask him? What would you like to know?
Okay, Dan, what would you ask Paul? Why he was on the front of the NME once with paint and hardly any clothes on. Did you remember that look?
That's like the topless one, right? Where he was in the woods with the bow and arrow.
He had a bit of a loincloth going. I mean, maybe you'd seen the Love Plus One video. I don't know. I'd ask him what that was all about, really. What was all that about then, Paul? You know, because I never knew. Maybe I should read the article. You know, it'll become clearer what that was all about.
I wonder who persuaded him to take those shots. I'd have to have a look and see who the photographer was and find out.
This is the guy that won't do Jam songs. This is the guy that won't do. I mean, there's no moving him on certain issues. It's just like, nope, you know, and that is it. And yet, look at that. You know, he's really pushed the boat out as far as some fashion decisions of.
Oh, wonderful. Nick, thank you so much for your time, man. I love chatting with you. Cheers
thank
for
joining me. It's been a joy. Thank you very much. And, you know, love to all the Jam fans out there, you know, like, respect.
Love, love, love that. What a lovely fella. Nick Haywood, so many amazing stories. And what a love of the Jam and Mr. Weller as well. So many nice connections in that episode. And I should say thank you so much to Nikki Weller for putting me in touch with Nick and sourcing out that connection. Much, much, much appreciated, Nikki. Thank you so much for listening. Do check out the show notes to this podcast on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Whilst you're there, you can get yourself a virtual coffee in our store, which gets you a shout out on the podcast as well. Hello to Steve Perry, who has done that in the past week. Andy Tolcher, hi to you. Also, Martin Morrow, thank you to you, sir, for your support. Brian G, Alex McLaughlin, who says, really enjoyed the chat with Suad Massey, another artist on the podcast that I wasn't aware of. I've enjoyed finding her music this week. Well, thank you, Alex. Hello to Steve Perry. Hi to Mike Steer. Smeg from the 829 Club. Hello, hello. Hi also to Jen, Stephen Cartwright, Stu Burns, Colin, Jane the Jam Tart with a Heart, Nick Keane, and Roger Clark. Thanks to you for all your support on your subscriptions. Keep them coming. PaulWellerFanPodcast.com. Thanks for all your support, as I say. Get in touch on social media at WellerFanPod on Twitter or on Facebook and Instagram. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.